This week on Assignment Radio, an OU professor was a contestant on this classic TV game show.
What is Jeopardy?
Correct.
Get a behind-the-scenes look at Kevin Butterfield's moment in the spotlight.
I was nervous. I was amped up, and some of that it was good energy, and some of it was definitely bad energy, and that it made it harder to give 100%, I felt.
Also on today's program, a University of Oklahoma dean shares her advice for career-minded women.
Find a role model. Find a mentor.
A former Marine experiences college for the second time.
The military was very good at training me to take knowledge that I had learned and actually apply it somewhere.
And what you'll want to know if you're thinking about purchasing what retailers say will be among the hottest gifts of the holiday season.
Flying is something that man's always wanted to do since the very beginning, is getting up in the air and flying. This is the next best thing.
But first, this hour's news from NPR. I'm Sarah Hurd, and welcome to Assignment Radio, KGOU's student-produced news magazine. Public radio is known for its powerful one-on-one interviews from hosts like Terry Gross and Diane Rehm. Today on Assignment Radio, a few of KGOU's student reporters try their hand at the format. One guest, one microphone, and a few questions to help us gain some insights into the lives and experiences of others. First, KGOU's Patrick Smith talks with a University of Oklahoma professor who displayed his knowledge a couple of months ago on a national stage, competing on one of America's longest-running game shows.
This is Jeopardy! Please welcome today's contestants, a history professor from Norman, Oklahoma, Kevin Butterfield.
Dr. Kevin Butterfield teaches classics and letters at the University of Oklahoma, and he may not be your typical professor. The walls of his office are lined with books and a painting of Thomas Jefferson, but Butterfield is also a big Kansas City Royals fan. He has Royals gear all over his office and is very excited the Royals won the World Series this year. But there's something more. Butterfield has done something most people have not. He was a contestant on Jeopardy, one of TV's longest-running game shows. Butterfield says it took two tries to get accepted as a contestant on the show.
I tried it years ago, never heard back, so clearly didn't do as well as I needed to do. And then I also tried last year, sometime in 2014, and took the test. I want to say it was in the month of September or something. And several months later, I got an email from Jeopardy asking me to go to a tryout someplace else. And that means that I got to the next stage, but that's by no means a slam dunk from that stage.
Since Jeopardy is such a smorgasbord of topics, how did you prepare to cover all of those bases, all of the possibilities, if there is a way to do that?
There's a lot that you cannot do. You can't cover everything. What you can get good at, and I did both of these things. You can get good at reading Jeopardy questions, or actually technically their answers, and then you give the question, what is North Dakota or something. Got good at reading Jeopardy questions. And the second thing you can do is just get down pat the obvious things that you probably should know, like the state capitals, the stuff that you may have learned in school but have forgotten. And you can get those things down. And then I started making this little notebook that I started just filling up with facts that I thought would be useful to know, like who invented the X-ray, you know, those kinds of things.
Before the taping, before the game actually started, that you were just like, please, I don't want that category anywhere on that board.
I'll give the answer that probably most people would give: opera. They sometimes ask opera questions, and I don't know. I in that little notebook I told you about, I did create a page for opera, and I learned some of the operas that Puccini wrote and some of the operas that Verdi wrote. But I would have been guessing on anything on opera, and I probably would have guessed wrong. So yeah, that was the one, opera.
Now, on the day of the taping, I'm assuming they do multiple in one day. Were nerves a factor at all for you?
You sit there and watch. They do five games in a day. They do a whole Monday through Friday of a week, all in one day. And this was on a Tuesday. And they did the first game and then drew names for the second game. And I wasn't drawn for that one either. And then they drew my name for the third game. And by then, yeah, I was nervous. I was amped up. And some of that was good energy. And some of it was definitely bad energy, in that it made it harder to give 100%. I felt a little stressed out. But the worst part about it was how nervous I was after. Just the lingering anxiety of it, the lingering nerves, coupled with I almost won a lot of money and I didn't. You know, it's like you have this moment where if things had gone slightly differently, you would have just paid off your student loan. You know, that kind of thing. And that just hangs with you for a little while.
And one thing I'm certainly curious about, what is Alex Trebek like in person?
So the dude is 75 years old, and he still looks great. And he's got energy. He's excited to be there. He looks as good in person as he does on camera. And he's really personable.
So you got second place. You have kind of dealt with the lingering regrets, maybe, of what could I have done differently. Do you have any plans to try out again?
Well, sadly, that's an easy answer. They don't let you try out again. It's a one-time thing. In theory, if Alex Trebek ever stops doing Jeopardy and they get a new host, apparently, the contracts that we all signed says that we can't be on Jeopardy again while Alex Trebek is the host. I can't try out for Jeopardy, and frankly, that's kind of a relief, because if I knew that I could, I would probably be spending a little bit of time in the evening studying up for Jeopardy and thinking about it and getting a little stressed out about it. So it's probably good that I can't. And it gives me a chance just to put it behind me and maybe go on Wheel of Fortune or something silly.
Dr. Butterfield recently got promoted to be the director of the Institute for American Constitutional Heritage for OU, something he says he's excited to focus on moving forward. For Assignment Radio, I'm Patrick Smith.
You're listening to Assignment Radio on KGOU. Suzette Grelot has many jobs at the University of Oklahoma. She's the dean of the College of International Studies, one of only three female deans at OU. She's also OU's vice provost for international programs and the William J. Crow Jr. Chair in Geopolitics. KGOU listeners know her best as the host of Worldviews, where she interviews visiting scholars about global current events. I talked to Suzette Grelot about how she balances it all and asked her how she manages to do a weekly radio show on top of her other responsibilities.
Well, Worldviews is my favorite activity, and it's not necessarily in my strict job description, but it serves the purpose of reaching out to the community and increasing international awareness through public radio, which is one of my favorite things on the planet. So nobody had to convince me to do Worldviews. Clearly not a professional journalist, but I'm a curious person. I love to ask questions, and I love to have conversations about international things.
Has increasing awareness of international issues kind of been something you've always been passionate about?
Always. I can't really say always, because I was born in Kansas, but raised in Oklahoma. So it's not like I was raised, you know, with a large international population, and I didn't have a lot of international opportunities when I was young. But it wasn't until really I was in college that I developed an interest in international issues, basically when the Berlin Wall fell. And so I started taking courses in Russian history and Soviet politics. I just found it to be very fascinating. And that's really when I developed my interest in and passion for international issues.
I'm taking a class here. In my dealings with my professor, I feel like an imposter. There's so many men that I run into on a daily basis that just seem so sure about stuff. And I have to think to myself, okay, actually, this is just kind of a different way that people communicate. Do you ever feel that way?
Well, sure. I mean, I there's a lot of interesting research on this, by the way, and a really great YouTube video, in fact, on confidence and particularly the author of this, she talks about how she felt like an imposter in graduate school. She would go to her advisor and just say, I just don't belong here. I'm not smart enough. I definitely felt that way. I've never felt like I'm the smartest person in the room. One thing I know, and the one thing that I think many of us women feel about ourselves, is that we're usually the hardest working people in the room. So I've always had to work hard to be as smart or to compete with my classmates and particularly my male counterparts. We as women often feel like we have to go over and above in order to demonstrate that we are worthy.
Can you tell me a little bit about balancing all the hard work that you do at the college with actually trying to have a life of your own that's separate from that?
Well, the answer I have is I don't have a lot of balance, and that's the problem, is that often, and I can't say that this is just the case for women, I do think that men suffer from this in some degree too, is just being able to balance that. And that's a hard thing to do when you have a high pressure, high stress position that doesn't last just from 8 to 5. It's very difficult, and I can't say that I do the best at it. But I do make time to spend with friends and family and to have some hobbies. And if you don't do those things, you're not going to be as productive, but I don't necessarily always practice what I'm preaching.
Okay, so you were talking about spending time with friends. You're very lucky. You and your assistant dean, Rebecca Cruz, are not only coworkers, but also kind of friends in real life. Can you tell me a little bit about the relationship and dynamic there?
I'm really lucky to have somebody in my life like Rebecca Cruz. You know, Rebecca was my student first. That's how I met her. She earned her PhD here. And I was on her committee. And so I had her in class as a student. And early on in her graduate career, she came to me and said, I would really like to learn how to do research. I'd like to get involved in a project. And this is really critical, particularly for women, I think, who are earning advanced degrees like that, is to find somebody to work with. And if you can, find a woman that can mentor you and guide you through your education, through your career. So we started doing research together, and then we started raising grant money together to do more research. And then so that led us to do a lot of international travel together. I think we've lost count. We've been to dozens of countries together doing research. She's the one go-to person. I mean, I think everybody needs to have this, particularly people in high-pressure jobs. You got to have somebody who's your confidant, and she's that person for me. And so I'm really lucky to have her as my colleague and my friend.
If you could give a piece of advice to women kind of your daughter's age, she's just starting at OU, and me, who's kind of on my way out, what would that be?
Never doubt yourself. And I think what's really important, as I was talking about Rebecca, find a role model, find a mentor. And women, quite frankly, are not terribly good at this, because women don't necessarily always support each other. And I think that's the other thing. For young women, remember to support each other.
Worldviews airs here on KGOU every Friday at 4 and 6:30 p.m. and Saturdays at 6 a.m. This is Assignment Radio, KGOU's student-produced news program. After serving a term in the U.S. military, many veterans use the GI Bill to pay for school. The opportunity for a paid education is a major draw for young adults, but the military isn't a good fit for everyone. Courtney Kirby has the story of a student veteran who has conflicted feelings about the time he spent in the Marines.
Jared Kuntz doesn't look like the stereotypical former Marine. When we met, he had on a baseball cap, t-shirt, and jeans with a short beard and longer hair. I almost missed him because I was looking for a military-like guy, someone with short hair and square shoulders. We met at the OU Student Union to talk about his time in the military and his return to college. Jared joined the Marine Corps in 2008 after giving school a try.
Honestly, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. As I originally started here, I think I did 3 semesters going to OU right out of high school. I had changed my major every time. There was no direction. And then I'm actually from Oklahoma City, so I moved back to Oklahoma City afterwards. And I started attending firefighter training at OSU OKC. But that was right around the time when the 2008 recession started. So I knew there wasn't going to be any jobs at that point. I just wanted to get out and go see something. Like, I really wanted to get out of home, and that was an easy way to do it.
Did you think about making the military a career?
I did, in so much as everybody does. As I mean, when you come out of boot camp, you're just, like, full of fire, and everybody thinks that's what they're going to do for the rest of their life. But very quickly, reality sets in, and I would say most people know if it's going to be the life for them or not within a year, and I knew it wasn't. 4 years was plenty for me.
How is school, like your perspective of school, different now that you've come back out of the military?
Oh, it's night and day from the first time I came here. Like school felt like something I was forced to do first time. Like it was just the logical step after high school. But I appreciate it now. Like I understand I have a reason I'm doing this. So, which I didn't have before. And on top of that, I would say the military was very good at training me to take knowledge that I had learned and actually apply it somewhere, rather than just viewing it as answering blanks on a test form.
Did your time in the military influence your, I guess, career path and what you chose to go to school for?
A little bit, because I was a linguist in the military. It's what I enjoy doing. And I'm currently dual majoring in linguistics and computer science. Well, computers in general has just been something I've always been fascinated with, I enjoy. And here I have an opportunity to go to college free to me. So I'm pursuing that, and I just get to continue my passion of linguistics as a ancillary benefit. Yeah, I would not say it steered me. But I am continuing with what I did in the military.
Would you say your time in the military focused what you want to do?
More focused what I don't want to do. I mean, there's not a whole lot I enjoyed about the job in the military. I mean, I love the Marines. Like, the people I serve with, I love them. But the job itself, I pretty much want to get as far away from that as possible.
How did the transition from active duty to civilian life shape what you do now?
At the risk of sounding arrogant, I feel I do have a better work ethic than some of my peers. I mean, it's, you know, every once in a while, everybody has a late assignment now and again or whatnot, but I don't think I have, and if I ever did, I would feel terrible about it, which would have absolutely been a possibility before joining the military. I see it as mission completion, essentially, whenever assignments are assigned and whatnot, and you don't just do it well.
Would you do it again, go to the Marines and then come back and do school?
I think we've all thought about that, and honestly, I have no idea. There's so many things about my time in the military that I just look back on it and I hate it. At the same time, I don't know where I'd be now. If I hadn't spent those 4 years doing that, who would I be today? I know I wouldn't be who I am. That much I can say, and I like who I am, quite frankly.
Jared Kuntz is a former Marine now attending college at OU and plans on graduating in May of 2017. For Assignment Radio, I'm Courtney Kirby.
This is Assignment Radio on KGOU. I'm Sarah Hurd. Drones are an increasingly common sight in the skies over Oklahoma and on lists of the most buzzed about gifts for this upcoming holiday season. Assignment Radio's Patrick Smith shares advice from a drone enthusiast and some aeronautics experts on what you should know before purchasing a drone.
Drone flying, both as a hobby and commercially, has seen a spike in popularity in the past few years.
Flying is something that man's always wanted to do since the very beginning, is getting up in the air and flying. This is the next best thing.
That's Don Price, a member of OKC Drones, a drone enthusiast group. I spoke to Price at their monthly meetup in southeast Oklahoma City. He's been flying remote-controlled vehicles for over 30 years, but got into drones in the past year due to the advances in technology.
Most of your modern consumer-grade drones have got GPS built into them. They've got computers built into them. If your batteries run low, it'll automatically fly home and land itself. They're basically flying computers.
Dr. Robert Huck is Director of Applied Research and Unmanned Systems with the Gallaglie College of Engineering at the University of Oklahoma. Huck says that making drones easier to fly is a big factor in their increasing popularity.
With the miniaturization of electronics and things and the autopilot systems and the composites and plastics manufacturing capabilities, these vehicles are now kit form. They have very stable autopilots. They're much easier to fly, whether it's a fixed wing or rotary wing. And the price has come down to under $100 for a vehicle that you can fly with remote control.
As exciting as drone flying can be, Hobbyist Don Price knows there are certain restrictions put in place by the Federal Aviation Administration that drone pilots need to know.
There are requirements set by the FAA that we fly below 400 feet and that we keep farther than 5 miles out from a military base or an airport. The proposals that are coming up to go into law, they're going to try and make it to where we cannot fly within 5 miles unless we have permission from the airport or the control tower of that venue.
There is also a distinct difference between hobby flying and commercial flying. Dr. Huck says the differences are clear.
So non-revenue generating, line of sight, RC frequencies, below 400 feet, that's hobby. If you're not doing that, you're not a hobby. And if you're not a hobby, then the FAA has to give you special authorization to do that.
Commercial use also includes flying over crowds of people. In order to use drones for commercial purposes, flyers have to get a Section 333 exemption from the FAA and register their drone. Ken Carson is the director of the Department of Aviation for the University of Oklahoma. Carson also emphasized the importance of flying safely and correctly.
It is a vehicle moving. It's kind of like a lawnmower. You know, you always want to make sure you're not mowing right next to someone. Well, same thing. You've got a vehicle with some rotor blades moving at a speed, and okay, if something goes wrong, is it going to, you know, crash into some people or some people you have on the side?
Don Price says a primary concern for drone enthusiasts is public perception.
The media has reported the problems with invading privacy, and that's a big issue with me. If someone is going to be videoing you and able to see you personally, you're going to know it. You're going to see their craft. You're going to hear it. 99.9% of the hobbyists out there could care less about that. They want to go out and fly. They want to catch stunning pictures, catch awesome video, different things.
Price also wants to make sure everyone knows the proper ways to start out if drone flying is something you want to get into.
It is much more advantageous to go out and spend the money on a good drone and it really enjoy the hobby, then take the chance on something that may or may not come falling out of the sky.
The U.S. Department of Transportation has set up a task force to study how to require registration for drones. The regulations may be in place by Christmas, when retail forecasters say drones will be a very popular gift. For Assignment Radio, I'm Patrick Smith.
For those interested in flying, Director Carson highly recommends visiting knowbeforeyoufly.com, an FAA-approved website that covers all the essential things flyers need to know before jumping into the hobby. Thanks for joining us for Assignment Radio, KGOU's student-produced public affairs program, focusing on issues and events around Oklahoma. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of KGOU or its licensee, the University of Oklahoma. I'm Sarah Hurd. Thanks for listening.